From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Alliance Theater's 50th anniversary comes to a new stage and a brand new production of Ever After. The musical is based on the late 1990s Drew Barrymore movie that retells the classic Cinderella story. The musical's opening night is this weekend, and joining us in the studio are Alliance Theater Artistic Director and Director of Ever After, Susan Booth. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Choreographer Joanne Hunter is also with us. Hello.
Hello there.
And lead actor Sierra Boggess. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Everybody was nodding along listening to that music. You've heard that a few times at this point.
A few, yeah.
Once or twice.
Well, Susan, Ever After follows the trend of movies from the 90s and 2000s being turned into musicals, like I think of Mean Girls and Waitress currently on Broadway. Can you give us a quick synopsis of the musical if folks listening haven't seen the movie?
Think about the Cinderella story as told through the lens of Cinderella, who not only saves herself, but also saves everyone around her. The magic is human magic. The fairy godmother is Leonardo da Vinci.
So she don't need no stinking prince.
She don't need no stinking prince.
Well, can we talk about the inclusion of Leonardo da Vinci in the musical and the movie? What role does he play in the story?
The great thing is, round about the time that Charles Perrault was writing one of the definitive versions of Cinderella, the King of France actually brought Leonardo to his court. It was in the last few years of Leonardo's life. He'd established himself mostly in Italy, but Francis brought him. And Leonardo transformed every community he entered because he was a man of science, of art, of culture, but most importantly, he was a man of deep soulful curiosity. He never accepted things at face value. He always asked, could it be better? Could it be other? Could it be different? Which is really what a fairy godmother provides for us, the capacity to see potential transformation.
And transformation, of course, a part of this story, although not by magic wand. Why did the Alliance Theater choose Ever After as its first production on this new stage?
It is a piece of spectacle, but as I say, it's human spectacle. It's a fierce story of female empowerment. And we're in an American moment right now where we need those stories and we're ready to listen to them. So it seemed the right thing at the right time.
Sierra, had you seen the film before taking on this role?
Oh, yes. It was one of those films that we all loved. I think I was in maybe high school when this movie came out, and I remember loving it. I had it on VHS. Remember that?
I've heard of it.
And the kids coming to see it now have not heard of VHS. But I specifically didn't rewatch the film once I knew that I was doing this production because, first of all, I don't want to recreate Drew Barrymore's amazing performance. That's hers. And I wanted to bring my own life and journey to this Danielle. Also, we're doing a completely different, it's the movie, but it's our version. So I wanted to make sure that I was not having that material so right there, like in my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Imprinted on you. That's
correct.
The thing. That must be the challenge in doing something like this. I wore that tape out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what's so cool, though, is I remember being inspired by it. And I remember feeling exactly what Susan was saying. This Cinderella story isn't the Cinderella story that we all, it's not Disney's Cinderella. And it's very real. And I remember loving that about the film, that it seemed so real. And she was so cool.
Well, Joanne, how about for you? I mean, this role, along with the movie, is about female agency and empowerment, as Susan said. How have you understand those ideas in your own work in the theater?
Oh, my goodness. well, I think, you know, when Susan approached me on this project, and I too went back to the movie, I hadn't seen it in forever. So I went back, and what I loved about it, it wasn't the typical Cinderella story, but it also, I mean, Drew and way to see Sierra, there is a fearlessness to her, and that's why I adore her, because I love fearless people. And it's not just about this a female empowerment and strength, but there's also vulnerability. And I think I said this in some interview that to me that makes a human whole. Do you know what I mean? So that the women are not just represented in one way, that we are everything. We have as much testosterone in our beings as we have the other things that make up us as a female, you know? And so, and I like self-sufficient women. I also like the door open for me, too. So I know that's kind of a...
We contain multitudes.
That's right. There you go. And so that's what I loved about this project, and knowing that the movement would have a much more heft to it, especially even from the women, which I was excited about. And I knew that Ciara could do that because I had worked with her before. So I was very fortunate to know that.
So Ciara said she didn't go back to the movie. You did.
I went only when the lovely Susan Booth called me on the phone and said, Ever After. Oh, yeah, I remember that movie. Let me watch the movie again. And I watched it, but that was it. I did not go. I've not gone back to it since. That was a year ago. That was it, yeah. And I remembered this, Drew Barrymore, she's charming and, you know, she's funny and lovely. And so I knew there was going to be humor. And then when I read the script, I went, oh, yeah, this is going to be fun.
And Ciara, you'd played other strong women. You were in Phantom of the Opera. How is Danielle different?
She's really humorous. That's one of my favorite things about this. She brings a lot of humor, even accidentally, to situations. The other roles that I'm known for are, people would call them more of a typical ingenue. And even though she is technically the ingenue in this, she has so much... she's also a tomboy, and she was raised by her father. Her mother died when she was born. So she's never really, the first woman that she's really known in her life is her stepmother, who is cold. And her father taught her to sword fight. And her father taught her hard labor. And she's been working in the home. She's been climbing trees. She's been running around. She's been chasing boys. You know, she's that, which was me. And by was, I mean still is.
That's Ciara Bogus, along with her choreographer Joanne Hunter and director Susan Booth from Alliance Theatre's production of Ever After. So this is the retelling of the Cinderella story. No fairy godmother. Danielle makes her own magic. How does this showcase her resiliency and intensity and intelligence throughout the production? Does it change?
Does her resilience change? Absolutely. The journey that Danielle takes, I mean, I'm physically exhausted by the end of the show, but I'm also emotionally exhausted. You know, the first half of my show, you see her. She's working in the house and she's trying to earn love, unfortunately, from her stepmother, which is something that she wants more than anything. And she accidentally falls in love with the prince. I mean, really accidentally. And what I also love about this love journey is that it isn't that both people are in sort of the same place. He is so not okay with his circumstances, just like Danielle is, but they're complete opposites. And so they find each other, and I think what makes them fall in love is how much they are just authentically who they are. And when she meets him, she thinks that he's arrogant as anything, and he probably thinks she's a little weird. I would. But that's a love story for the ages.
So not your typical princess, but... Susan, I'll put this to you. Princesses have fallen out of favor in contemporary storytelling in favor of big superhero stories. How do you sell folks on a princess in 2019?
You think about Meghan Markle. You think about cultural leaders. You think about people who have finally the authority to make enormous decisions on behalf of the people whom they rule. I have a 14-year-old daughter, and when she was of the age that one would read fairy tales, I violently refused, because that trope of the winsome girl in the tower who required rescuing was something that I didn't want my kid thinking was a definition of female character. I think princess means you are part of a royal family. It means you have responsibility. It means you can, if you choose, have great agency. This is that story.
Mm. And this is set in France during the Renaissance. You mentioned that Leonardo da Vinci was called in at the time that this was first created. How do you convey that time in sets, costumes, choreography, for example, Joanne?
When doing anything that is a period piece, no matter what it is, you know, you for me, not everyone, for me, there's a research, and I look at a lot of photos. I actually look more photos than any type of video because I want to see what comes out of my head. But then we're also not doing a documentary, so we have to be able to understand the world that we're living in within the confines of the stage, of the theater, of the piece. But then being able to then also make it right for today's audience. So, you know, you can't just do a gavotte because it's only so many steps and it's in today's, in our mentality, it's a little one note, you know. So, but for me, I when I research, I find a base and then I figure out, then I get into a studio and I start figuring out where does the vocabulary live. And sometimes it takes me forever. And then once I find, it could be just eight counts. Once I find, I go, okay, then I go from there. But I always try to come from a place where the piece lives and then grow from there. And hopefully that doesn't stray too far and stays within tone.
How do you modify the choreography to fit the new stage? It's a different space. I don't know if you'd worked on the previous stage at Alliance
Theater. I did work on the previous stage. I did Harmony here, which I loved. And you know what? I always say when I teach, when we're in rehearsal, I always say to the actors and the dancers, okay, blah, blah, blah. And then I'll say, just don't marry this because it's all going to change. I say you can give yourself a little promise ring, but that's it. And because on stage, everything. And also, when we're in the studio, we are on top of the actors. We're maybe, if we're lucky, 5 to 7 feet from them. So when we get in the theater, we're able to step back so then you can see the whole picture even more clearly. And that's when you realize, oh, God, that's not going to work. Oh, that's going to work. And then you have to figure that out while you're in tech. So it's not just the technical aspect that we're working, but also finessing what we've done in the studio. And it always changes. I always say my first try is never the finished product. Rarely does it stay the same.
I'm wondering if you have favorite songs from the production. And what do they tell us about the characters that go beyond the dialogue?
Oh, I'm so happy to talk about the score. I think it's one of the most incredible scores that I have ever gotten to sing. And I've got to sing some really cool stuff in my career. There is nothing like this score on Broadway right now. This is the type of music that made me want to do this for a living in musical theater. The way that Zena writes is just, it's like sitting in a comfortable armchair. It's just, she really, really understands how each character would sing. And for Danielle, I have Who Needs Love is such an awesome I want song by saying I don't need this, but it's obviously all subtext. And lyrically, Marcy, who's done the lyrics, it's so clever. And the audience, we hear this every night. The audience responds to it. They're laughing and you can hear people sniffing and so crying. And it's just heaven. It feels like such an awesome match of this lyricist, this composer, and with these characters.
Stay with us. There's more on Second Thought coming up after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, here with a crew of people who are essential to Alliance Theater's new production of Ever After. They're opening their 50th anniversary season on a new stage with a brand new production of Ever After. With me is Susan Booth. She's Artistic Director of Alliance and Director of the play, and the choreographer Joanne Hunter and lead actor Sierra Boggess. Well, this has been remembered as many people as a movie, clearly, and now as a musical, although not seen here in Atlanta. And Joanne, you started out as a dancer in live stage on Broadway. How did your experience as a dancer influence your job and your approach and your way of thinking about whole productions?
I think for all the many years I was on the Broadway. that's a cigarette hanging out of my mouth right now.
I can hear it.
Thank you. You know, I understand what it's like to be on stage. I understand the process of standing and waiting for lighting. So you know what I mean? So I think for me, I understand that it takes a lot of patience and it's tiring. So I can bring that to the table. I also know as a performer for myself personally that when I danced, when I performed, I always needed a reason why. That it couldn't just be for steps. And if I didn't have it, for some reason, maybe it was not in the text or was not in however it was choreographed, for whatever reason, I had to find something to make it work for me. So when I create, I think that has influenced me in creating that I always want to tell story. I cannot just make up steps for the sake of steps. It's just not part of who I am. I need a reason why. So for me, book is the utmost importance. And it's the first thing I read. I'll read the script over and over again, and then the music, and then I get in the room with my dance arranger. But I want to continue telling the story. That's why book musicals, I prefer that. That's why I'm not a contemporary dancer. I prefer to continue storytelling. And I like that. I like the challenge because telling story without any words can be challenging, you know, because especially if you're used to hearing dialogue and then they go into a song and, okay, how do I continue plot without saying the same thing we've just heard?
And while you are reading the book, do you begin to see how the movement would work in your head?
Not always.
As we said, these things change, right?
Yes, yes. I think, you know, there's certain, sometimes something will pop out immediately. I go, oh my God, I can see this. Where this whole end of act one, this bohemian number, I knew, because just knowing the path of Danielle, which I love because she, like Sierra said, she's a tomboy. I was a tomboy. I played baseball. I played football. My brother was a huge athlete. I wanted to be just like him. I wanted to do anything a guy could do. If he could jump, I could jump. So I love that Danielle is a tomboy. And I love the fact that because she was raised by her dad, who only knew how to raise her as a male, right? So he knew what he knew. He knew how to, that he had to chop wood. And so all of that influenced what I was going to do in that number. So with that, I knew immediately. Other stuff, I didn't know immediately.
Susan, you said that you raised a daughter, a princess-free daughter for the most part. Were you a tomboy also?
Oh, yeah. I was the youngest of four, and all the cool things had already been taken by my older siblings. They were excelling at everything I wanted to excel at, so I had to find my own thing. But I don't know how it happened, but it was never a given. I don't remember my mother sitting me down and saying, "Thou shalt not," but it was never a given that I fit into any of the feminine stereotypes. It was never given that I wouldn't, but I was made to know it was my choice. And I think now what a gift that was, that was how I was raised. And so I'm trying to raise my kid that way, and I gravitate towards stories that really screw with our traditional definitions, whether it's of gender or class, work that says, question that assumption.
Do you think that maybe part of what pointed you towards theater, you know, discovering dimensions of people that were far beyond the flat way that they're often presented?
Well, that's a cool thing about our art form, right? Is we walk through the world every day and we bounce off hundreds and hundreds of people. When you sit down in the theater, you make a pact that you're going to pay attention to human beings. You're going to pay attention to what they do, what they say, what they don't say. You're going to pay attention to the way they connect with one another. And you're going to bring all your assumptions and experiences to bear. But I think it's the most sacred thing we can do as human beings right now is to commit to spending a couple of hours looking at other human beings with empathy and curiosity.
For you, Sierra, on stage, that's a big responsibility. It's a pact, obviously, but you're being looked to provide something. How does that feel for you, especially when you want to gain depth, you want to show the depth of a character?
Mm-hmm. I have this saying that I've been saying for 10, 11 years that's, you have nothing to prove, only to share. And I really do have that mantra before I go on, because if I go out there trying to prove, then everybody's going to miss out on the journey that we want them to have. And it also isn't mine. It isn't Sierra's. It's everyone. And I'm working with some really, really awesome people up on the stage, too.
I know from colleagues at Alliance Theater celebrating the 50th anniversary, we talked about the redesign of the stage, which is much more intimate now, from what I understand. This is going to be the first time mounting a production there. And Susan, you have mounted several. What is it like working in this new, more intimate stage setting?
I don't always know how to get from the house to backstage. It's like that sometimes. We're in the preview period right now, which means we rehearse during the day, and then at night, the designers and Joanne and I sit out in the audience and we watch. And it's pretty glorious to sit in this room where it's a conversation. It is not a sterile production. In our old space, we had this orchestra pit that was giant, and it was like a big moat that performers had to push their performances across. And this is this communal conversation, and it supports intimate moments. It supports enormous spectacle-driven moments. It's a lovely place to be for a few hours.
So that is going to bring your audience even more close. And I'm thinking that there will be young women who are tomboys. There may be young men who are fighting with their identities, as we've been hearing. Parents who, you know, are raising children and sure of their limitations, or the person with a stepmother who is cold. Any thoughts on what you would like for people to take away from this production?
I love the idea of inclusion in this piece. There are a lot of beautiful messages, but I think what Danielle sees in human beings is that they're all human beings, no matter what their station is. And I use quotation marks in that. It doesn't matter. And I think I love that. That's one of my favorite messages that Ever After portrays.
Leonardo sings to Danielle a lyric that sticks in my head every single night. Prisoners of circumstance, what if it wasn't true? We all walk through our days with these thou shalt and thou shalt not assumptions about how we're confined or how we're limited by where we were born or what we studied or didn't study or what's in our bank account or not in our bank account. But what if none of that were true? What if absolutely anything we wanted to accomplish was possible? Wouldn't we walk through the world a lot differently, a lot more lightly?
Beautiful thing to take away as we thank you all. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Susan Booth, she's artistic director and director of Ever After, choreographer Joanne Hunter, and lead actor Sierra Boggess from Alliance Theater's upcoming production of Ever After. In 2018, Georgia farmers faced a number of challenges, from Hurricane Michael, which wiped out crops that need years to replenish, to roller coaster trade tariffs. While these issues have an impact on the financial stability of Georgia farmers, there's also another aspect to consider, their mental health. But it's not easy to track and not easy to change.
With farming, it's a way of life. It is not an occupation. So to tell them, why don't they sell their cows, or why don't they sell their land, or why don't... That's like saying, why don't you cut off my arm?
GPB reporter Ross Terrell has been following this story and joins us now in the studio. Ross, welcome.
Hello.
So, as we mentioned, 2018, very difficult year for farmers. Hurricane Michael wiped out crops, what should have been a good harvest. Also, orchards worth of trees that came down in some cases and will take years to grow back. And the trade tariffs. How did these add stress for the state's farmers?
Right. Well, you talk about the hurricane, and last year you had a drought, you have tornadoes, you have a hurricane this year. So it just seems to be one thing after another that farmers can't escape. And then you talk about the trade war going on with the tariffs. So not only do you not have your crops, but now these crops are more expensive. As you heard from a farmer earlier last year on your show, who said, go to the store, buy Georgia pecans, buy our stuff, because other countries aren't, and we need your support. And all of that just kind of adds up to a ball of financial stress and struggle.
So in addition to that financial stress, which is kind of part of the way of life for many farmers, mental health is something that we don't hear very much about. Why is that?
Right. Well, that's not really an issue where there's too much research. It's kind of like you can't research something that's not happening. And then the number of people I talk to, psychiatrists, people in the rural community, they simply say farmers don't walk through our door. We don't see them. We don't hear from them. And the CDC did release a report in 2016 looking at suicides by occupation, and agriculture and farming was top on that list, but that report has been retracted. And a lot of studies and reporting was based on that number. But now that that study is in question, it's hard to kind of get a grip on how many people are actually struggling with mental health, which is more than just committing suicide. It could be depression, bipolar, but people just in rural communities aren't searching for help.
Or is it that they're not searching for help, or maybe they don't have as much access? Do we know?
It's a combination. Right. You talk about farmers, they're a prideful bunch. And it's this idea that, well, I don't want to kill myself. I'm not going crazy. So why do I need to get help? And then you're also talking rural communities where the closest point may be an hour away. And it's a heavy reliance on the community around them, the church community, neighbors, family. If you're a young farmer and you just started, you talk to your dad, you talk to your mom. But the idea of searching for help just really isn't prevalent in this community.
Some of the farmers did, however, speak to you. Here's Casey Cox, a Georgia farmer, sharing her fears.
I don't want to be the generation that loses the farm. I don't want to be the person that has to sell the farm and move away because I couldn't manage it properly. I want to be a good steward of this land and the business that my family has spent generations building.
That is a considerable legacy. Does that add to the burden that these younger farmers feel?
Absolutely. And talking with Casey, she actually left and went to college and felt drawn to come back to farm. So I don't want to say she had an out, but there was another career path for her. And when you talk six generations, I don't know too many people that have that many people in your family or in your lineage doing the same thing. And so for her, it's, well, my parents made it through their challenges. Our family made it through the 80s, which was a really rough time for farmers. So now that pressure is on me. But the state of the challenge has changed. You talk about a Category 3 storm, something that Georgia's never seen. You talk about these trade wars. You talk about climate change. It's a different challenge. And when you have the pressure of your parents and your great-grandparents doing it, giving up is not an option. And that's something that I heard over and over is walking away, quitting, that's not even a choice for a lot of these farmers.
And also, this is a huge part of the Georgia economy, and that would be devastating.
Right. And driving around, I was down in Camilla, Georgia, which is southwest, a little further south in Albany. I think there's this idea of two Georgias, and a lot of people in this urban setting don't realize how much agriculture truly does play into Georgia's economy. You talk about top crops in the nation and pecans and cotton and just peanuts, how much that Georgia farmers grow. It's easy to forget that they are a large driving factor in Georgia's economy, and a reason that Brian Kemp campaigned so heavily there to let them know you aren't forgotten. I do realize, you know, how important you are.
Well, I know that throwing money at mental health issues isn't necessarily a fix, but how about the money that was proposed by former Governor Nathan Deal to help farmers out and a general session okayed it? Is that offering any sense of relief?
Right. So that is giving them a lot of financial help, which we know they need to recover. But there was also a lot of money from federal partners that went into offering mental health. And there's a project called the Georgia Crisis Recovery Program, which actually takes farmers with these shared experiences, people who went through storms themselves, who have farmed, who have lost, and who have recovered, and it sends them out to the farmers. So instead of, hey, come to us, why aren't you coming to us? It's, okay, wait a minute. We'll bring these services to you. We'll take people, we'll send them to your doorsteps and let you know, here are the resources available. If you need help, here's where to go. Here's how to find us. And it's really kind of tying this entire network together, let people know we are here for you and we can help, and selling hope. And that's what this comes down to, is there is hope. Don't give up.
Have you spoken to people who actually do that work? Have they made it in the door? Have they had any kind of success in connecting with the farmers?
They're in the early stages. They have about a $150,000 grant. They right now have about five counselors who are just getting started. I did talk to Charlotte Austin, who is in charge of that program. And she has said, you know, the phone has started ringing more. I am hearing from farmers now saying, I just need to talk. I just need someone to be there for me. And a lot of times that's what it is. It's just a voice letting you know you can get through this. If you need to come in, we can go get coffee. We can go talk. But a lot of times that's what they need. Something simple saying it's going to be okay.
You mentioned that they are a prideful bunch. Is there a stigma that goes with mental health?
Absolutely. Not only in farming, but I think anywhere there's a stigma you have to overcome. It's especially challenging when you talk farmers. The two things that I heard from Ted Matthews, who actually travels around doing this work, he said is you got to build trust. More than likely, farmers aren't going to come to you. They aren't going to seek it out. And then you have to get them to look at mental health as physical health. You exercise not because you're sick, but because you want to stay healthy and that it is okay. Mental health doesn't mean illness. It doesn't mean sickness. It just means I need to get healthier. Why not? And that's really what that stigma is, hey, it's okay to talk to someone. It's okay to take some time off. It's okay to say, I need help.
Do you think with more awareness, there may be more of an effort to address these kind of issues?
I think so. I think the money is there. The USDA has invested millions of dollars in rural health, and a lot of those grants have gone to these community mental health associations. And I think sometimes it takes a storm like Hurricane Michael for people to step back and say, not only are they struggling financially, but there could be a mental struggle associated with this.
GPB reporter Ross Terrell, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more of On Second Thought after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Brendan O'Connell has been called the Warhol of Walmart. After growing up in Tarker, Georgia, and graduating from Emory, he moved to Paris and discovered a talent for painting and a penchant for painting people doing mundane things, which landed him in the fluorescent aisles of the world's largest retailer. By O'Connell's account, he's been thrown out of dozens of Walmarts. Then the company embraced his scenes of shoppers picking up toothpaste and still lives of marshmallow fluff and Cheerios. His work sells for tens of thousands of dollars. And how many visual artists do you hear on late-night talk shows like The Colbert Report?
My guest tonight is an artist who does impressionist paintings of Walmart shoppers. His painting costs $14.99 for a pack of six.
O'Connell's work is on view at a new show at Spalding Nick's Fine Art in Atlanta. And Brendan O'Connell, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Virginia.
Well, thank you for being here. You are now on to other things, but I'm really curious about what attracts you to these everyday people and spaces.
There's something about when you go into any environment like Walmart or any grocery store, is people are active doing things, and it's one of the few places on earth where you can see the wide economic range from people who don't have money to people trying to get a bargain on a TV.
So how did you start with the Walmart?
Well, part of the thing was I was in Europe for 7 years, and when I came back, Walmarts were everywhere. And the idea of painting America as it is today, in the way that there were a lot of painters throughout American art history, like Edward Hopper, and who came back from Europe to paint America. So that was kind of the idea.
So you followed that path.
I followed that path.
You did not study painting.
I did not study painting, though I did 10,000 caricatures in front of Notre Dame, if that's a sort of art school. The post-impressionists in France were doing commercial boulevard paintings of markets and commerce, and in some ways, Walmart has those boulevards underneath one roof.
Huh. So you were capturing and, in many ways, elevating these big box interiors and shelves crammed with Lucky Charms and Cheetos. Do you find beauty in them, or is it something else?
In some respects, that was the original goal of, like, what if we can find beauty and make art out of the most common overlooked places? And I did find it kind of compelling that, when I was in college, I was a stock boy in a grocery store, and I always thought the colors were very mesmerizing. And later, when I became a painter, I had distinct memories about it.
In where? Winn-Dixie, I think.
Winn-Dixie. In Florida.
I don't know. I think about how the last thing I want to do is go to the supermarket.
I think our relationship to convenience has changed everything. You know, people say one of the biggest things that changed America was when I was in eighth grade, I was at a friend's house and he called Domino's Pizza for the first time, and we got a pizza and we didn't have to leave. We didn't have to get our parents to drive us anywhere. And just the idea that cable television and delivery of food made it unnecessary to really go anywhere. And so that was a huge transition of where we are in relationship to how we consume things and how we interact. So in some ways, the big box store is one of the last physical places where people interact beyond, say, airports or bus stations, but they're not really interacting with their environment in the same way.
And now it's internet shopping and Postmates, so they never need to leave their home.
In some respects, that. But 10 years ago when I started this project, I kept thinking, my kids will tell their kids, you know, there was this place where you could ride a bicycle down an aisle and then get a loaf of bread, you know, like that you could actually touch things before you bought them, which I think we're going to still maintain that in a boutique sort of way, but any sort of bulk convenience is definitely going to be delivered.
When I was reading about your stuff, I was thinking, I used to live in New Hampshire, and in a lot of rural places, when you go to that, you know, the misconnections thing on Craigslist, when you see somebody,
yes.
And so many of them were at Walmart.
That's very funny. Well, the original idea of Walmart was to only open in towns that had less than 10,000 people.
That has changed.
That has changed dramatically, yes.
Now the largest retailer and largest employer in the world?
At least in the U.S.
Yeah, so this is probably one of few places where people do interact.
Yeah, or there's the risk of an encounter. And that's one of the things that I keep thinking about is like a lot of things in life, you know, if you stay home, your likelihood of running into anyone is very low. But you go outside in a place like New York City and you run the risk of running into 1 of 8 million people. But Walmart allows that encounter, as you said, the missed encounters.
And you have been, by your own account, thrown out of several Walmarts.
Yes, that was kind of pre the New Yorker, that up until then I would go in and take a picture and we would get shuttled out. But after the New Yorker, I kind of had carte blanche I think at this juncture they would let me set up an easel in any Walmart in the world, you know.
But that's, the New Yorker did an article on you, and tell me how...
The relationship developed?
Yes.
So in 2010, I did a show in Boston, where I was on Boston Public Radio, and I said I'd been thrown out of more Walmarts than most New Yorkers had ever been in. And then Walmart called me about a half hour later and said, we like what you do, and we'd love to make it easy on you going there.
So did you get into bed with Walmart, as they say?
Well, see, my goal was never to kind of make a punchline of art, because I feel like the conversation stops once you hit a punchline. If you do a painting of a 6-foot bag of Cheetos, people can think one thing or another. And I mean, right now I'm doing this funny little series called Sexy Cereal, where I have 3 different figures in front of cornflakes, and my stand-up comedian friend called them Pornflakes 1, 2, and 3. But there's an African-American man. There's my next-door neighbor's kid, who's a Calvin Klein model, underwear model, in front of one, and then I have a blonde in front of a third. But cereal was the first product marketed to kids, and just the absurdity of connecting sex to any kind of product. It's kind of funny and weird.
But people have those associations.
We do.
I don't necessarily think sexy with cornflakes, but there are all sorts of different associations, and generally they begin with me being a kid and staring at a cereal box.
Right.
Making cornflakes.
Right, right. Yeah, they usually didn't have underwear-clad people on those
Not
boxes.
Back in my day. But this is why you've been compared to Andy Warhol and other painters like, I'm thinking also of Wayne Thiebaud, is that how you pronounce
Correct.
His name? You know, he did gumball dispensers, and of course Andy Warhol did soup cans. But it was that part of your thinking when you started painting, you know, marshmallow fluff and cornflakes?
There's something inherently neutral or cold about a brand, and the idea of putting it in paint makes it warmer. In the way that nostalgia makes our memories warmer, paint can make this a warmer idea. So this show that I'm doing with Richard T. Scott at Spalding Gray, we're 2 very different artists, both from Georgia, who have traveled to Europe and kind of settled in the Northeast. We're having this conversation about America today and the identity of America today. And he comes at it from more of a historical perspective, and I come at it more from a pop culture contemporary perspective.
My guest is Brendan O'Connell, who got pretty famous for paintings of Walmarts. Now he's in a new show with painter Richard Thomas Scott, opening tonight at Spalding Nick's Fine Art in Atlanta. It's called Bringing It All Back Home. I'm interested in that you both grew up in Georgia, now live in the Northeast. Was there a bigger market that you were looking for there? Was there something else involved with your leaving Atlanta?
I went to Europe to just kind of find a life that wasn't on the menu, you know? And after being there for 7 years, I came back to New York to be an artist, which I guess that's what people do, and then ended up moving to the country. But in some respects, the Northeast, certain pockets 100 miles outside of New York City, is more like the South than the South is today.
What do you mean?
Well, we don't have the sprawl that they do in the South now. So, you know, I go to the dump and get rid of my trash, and that's where I run into my neighbors and hear stories, which feels like the olden days in the South, you know, where your encounters with people. I live in a very rural area, and it just reminds me more of what Tucker was when I was growing up here. Tucker, like, I could walk 4 miles behind my house and not see another house, and now there are houses everywhere.
So
and Chick-fil-A's.
But you do live in a part of the world, you know, surrounded by the New York art world or the sprawl of New York City. People who generally protest Walmarts moving into town. What do they think of these paintings?
It's weird because half the people from the beginning who bought my paintings, it was the first piece of quote-unquote contemporary art they bought, and the other half were veteran collectors who spent annually a lot of money on art. So I don't know. I'm in this weird niche of part but not part of the New York art world.
But Walmart is a favorite target. It's also a symbol of consumerism gone wrong, but it's also a savior of many small town economies or labor forces or death of mom and pop stores or affordability or helping people out during disaster. So there are so many things. So did people there assume that you were making a joke, you know, making fun of Walmart?
I think the original, when people ask what I do and I said, well, I got known for doing paintings about Walmart, first, could you repeat that, please? You know, you know, no one had really addressed this kind of behemoth of American culture in a direct way. And you know where things begin, but you don't know where they end. And I started this as, isn't a slice of American life. And then 10 years later, there were many segments of sometimes I focused on brands, sometimes I focused on that weird sense of architecture, like paintings and... Anyway, so I've had different permutations, and now thinking more about where we are in relationship to stuff and who we are, like how people actually identify with a brand. Yeah, I find that fascinating.
We're living in a culture where brand identity is absolutely everything. And you are painting and identified with Walmart. Do they see you as their
mascot?
Company art? Yes.
I think it was one of those things where I don't think either of us really thought there would be that train of media following this idea.
So you didn't think, like, how to be a successful artist
no.
would involve painting Walmart?
No, I think I'd be a lot richer if I had pre-thought this out. Anyway,
but you have achieved a lot of fame. I mean, it's rare to see an artist on CBS Sunday Morning or the Colbert Report. Of course, they do end up in the New Yorker. But now that you've built this, you have a brand identity, I guess, on some level. Is there a temptation to go with what works?
Well, there's none in this show, but I have been exploring the idea of people's interior spaces, and I'm doing a series on Airbnb. But the idea on that is we let strangers in our homes. We rent them the guest room. That to me is just bizarre and amazing that that exists, and you have this window into people's worlds that didn't exist before. And the parallel relationship of Airbnb and Walmart is similar in that we cheer a company or a brand until they're at the top of the heap. And then once they're at the top of the heap, every bullseye is on their back shooting arrows. And every day I get an article about both.
You mean like that things go wrong?
Different horror stories and or, you know, different lobby groups who hate Airbnb. And it's been the same with Walmart and Airbnb, the parallels into once you become the giant, everybody wants to take you down. It's very American to build something up, the underdog up, and then once they're the big dog, then we tear them down.
Are you doing paintings of the spaces or the hosts?
Both. People in their spaces.
The title of the show is Bringing It All Back Home.
Correct.
Is there any sense of identity with the South and you're thinking about what home is and bringing it back home?
I have some tennis lady paintings where I had a tab tennis lady, which reminded me of growing up in Atlanta and this aspirational view of what Buckhead was that may or may not still exist. And I have a Diet Coke tennis lady, which is more contemporary. I feel like the fact that both Richard and I left the South in a conscious way and have periodically come back, you know, I think you could title any show after a line from a Bob Dylan song. So that's a personal favorite, but it's just the idea of addressing American identity. You know, my sensibilities growing up here. There's something in Flannery O'Connor about the idea of you leave here with a sense of irony that you don't necessarily have in the Northeast inculcated in you. Like in some ways, you know, smart Southerners are a lot funnier than brash, no nonsense Northeast. Do you know what I mean?
Tell me more.
it's sort of the difference between Hemingway, who's fascinating, but humorless on some level. And Flannery O'Connor is always weirdly funny. I feel like that exemplifies the culture. There's something weirdly funny from the Southern perspective.
And your paintings too?
Sometimes I would definitely say in the sexy cereal and in the tennis ladies, and I definitely think there is humor in a lot of them.
I guess you could also always use the line that you've been thrown out of better places than Walmart.
I have.
Have you been thrown out of better places than Walmart?
I definitely have defined better, but been thrown out of places. So.
Brendan O'Connell, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Brendan O'Connell's new show with painter Richard Thomas Scott is called Bringing It All Back Home, and it's opening tonight at Spalding Nick's Fine Art in Atlanta and will be on view for the entire month. Well, that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alec Caslow is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. We always love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.